high grade in the class.
Also the average of the class?
Yeah, also the low grade.
Jeez. You did better than everybody else in line.
Right, so let's see. None of this is screwed up.
Thank you.
Right, here's the promise of midterm. And, you should take this seriously if you're not your color.
you take this seriously.
So there are three problems on the midterm. We should turn the midterm in on Wednesday. The midterm should take you maybe 2 hours at the most, somewhere around 2 hours. The first problem should be really easy, and you'll probably solve it while you're sitting here in class. And the second problem and the third problem, you can do both of those if you follow the directions and know how to add points together on elliptic curves. That's really all you need to know, really. And you might have to think a little bit about how to change equations and remember some algebra, but this shouldn't be too hard. It should be pretty straightforward. Second, does everybody have a copy of these notes?
Which ones?
The ones that begin as a table of contents. So this is the contents for a book I'm currently writing called Computing with Modular Forms. And I'm going to start going through this book for the rest of the class. Obviously, I won't go through the whole book. I'll probably just do some excerpts from chapter one and probably chapter 5 and a little bit of chapter 6 in the remaining month. If there's interest, I'll continue to talk about some other parts of this next quarter, even though there won't be an official class. How many of you are still going to Stark's class? Two of you? Three? Okay. So there'll be some overlap now because I'm also going to talk about modular forms. But he's talking about them only in the case of level 1 right now. SL2Z,
yeah.
And I'll talk about them in more generality, and probably the flavor will be a lot different since I'm focused on how to compute them rather than something about the number of zeros that they have. Okay, any questions or comments before I start on modular forms?
First question.
On the homework, yes.
On the midterm?
I mean midterm, sorry.
You have 2, 3 included in there.
What's wrong with that? The NP is just the number of points, so
okay.
It makes sense to consider the number of points. But yeah, you're right, those are, or at least, yeah, those aren't primes of good reduction for that model, but they're still points. Let's see, also homework, you notice I didn't hand out the homework, but actually I did. It's at the very end. Exercises, section 1.9 of this handout is the homework. So these are various questions related to modular forms. And I'll be talking fairly precisely about modular forms, unlike how I did at the beginning of the class. So instead of an overview now, this will be much more precise. And the ultimate goal, there are two things. One is that you understand what a modular form is. And two, understand how to compute them. And in connection with this, I want you to understand what it means for an elliptic curve to be modular. So I won't just be talking about, say, modular forms for SL2Z, but modular forms in enough generality that you will see the connection with elliptic curves and abelian varieties. And then how to compute them. Basically, there aren't very many people that know how to do this in general.
I will explain some of how that works. This is what a lot of my thesis was about, actually. Okay, so they will be about one for the most part.
I'm going to start with the basic definitions. If you're in Stark's class, the one difference is that I will talk about level n instead of level 1. And there's a lot more breathing room there. Level 1 is very special. Okay, so first, let's get started.
So, h is the upper half plane. I think we've already talked about that a few times. So, complex numbers with positive imaginary part. Basically, I'm giving you a sequence of definitions today with some comment about them. So, here's our upper half plane for today. And you might remember from day one, SL2R, 2x2 matrices with determinant 1 and real entries. And inside of that, SL2C, the modular group, which is the group of 2x2 matrices with integer entries and determinant 1. And one of the basic facts about the modular group is that it's generated by the following two matrices, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1, 0, 1. So these are two elements of SL2Z, and together you get every single element of SL2Z from these two. Yes?
Is the upper half plane include?
No, it does not. So, so for me, the upper half plane is the Z and C with the imaginary part of Z strictly greater than 0.
There's a compactification of this gap by obtaining adjoining the rational numbers Q to the upper half plane.
But you don't want to adjoin all of R. So SLT is generated by these two matrices. There is a nice accessible proof in Sarah's book, A Course in Arithmetic. I'm not going to do the proof in here, but you can see this in Sarah's. It's in the last chapter. The idea of the proof is to determine a fundamental domain for the action of SL2Z on the upper half plane via linear fractional transformations. So the way that works, is you have a matrix A, B, C, D. It acts by sending Z to AZ plus B over CZ plus B. And it turns out that for SL2Z, if you consider this subset of the complex numbers, which is described more precisely in here, at the bottom of page 9, then each element of the upper half plane is conjugate to, that is equivalent under the action of SL2Z, that is, there exists a matrix sending it into exactly one plane in here, except possibly on the boundaries. So everything is equivalent to exactly one thing in here. So if you think of the upper half plane as a modulo of the action of SL2Z, then you can imagine it as being this fundamental domain but with the edges identified. But this is a fundamental domain for SL2Z. Proving that is most of the work. Once you have that, then you can pretty easily see that these two generate. And again, I refer you to Sarah's book, A Course in Arithmetic, for the details of this argument. Yes?
Is there just an easy proof where you take, just take A, B, C, D, and do?
No. I don't think so. I don't think there's an easy proof.
But just an arithmetic, do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh,
a purely combinatorial proof that A
you're probably right, actually. Let's see. Like something involving continued fractions, maybe. I would be surprised.
Challenge one more time.
Yeah.
There's probably an argument that would use facts about continued fractions, but I've never thought of it. But I would be surprised. Challenge problem. If you can find a simple proof of this, I'd be interested. But I don't think... I'd be surprised. I haven't seen such a thing. I think even the algorithm you use when you want to do it in practice involves taking an element and then getting it into this. But the way the algorithm works kind of looks like continued fractions. So there could be a continued fractions proof that these are equal. I don't know. But certainly Sir makes no mention of that, and I've never seen an elementary proof. So this statement will be useful because it will allow us to write down a simple condition for whether or not something is a modular form. Also, something I think I'll talk about a little bit later is how if you have a subgroup of SL2Z of a special type, which I'll define later in this lecture, certain subgroups. There's an interesting algorithm for computing generators for the subgroup. And it certainly relies on known generators for SL2Z. So I'll talk about that a little bit later. And if you look at the top of page 10, I've inserted a little bit of Sage code, which won't work for you because I just wrote it this morning. But if you say, it will work in a few days, but when I upload the newest version, but you can say SL2Z and then ask for the generators, and it gives you, it's not really that amazing. But, now some very basic complex analysis. So here are two definitions that some of you have surely seen, but some of you might not have seen. So a function f, these definitions naturally make more sense, or make sense on other domains. But if you have a function from the upper half plane to the complex numbers, then you say that it's holomorphic. If f prime of z is defined for all z in H. And of course you can make sense of this for any open subset of the complex plane, but I'll just define it for H. And what does it mean for f prime to be defined? All that means is that, well, here's the definition of f prime. It's the limit as h goes to 0 along any path you want of f of z plus h minus f of z over h. Just the usual, that's just like the usual definition of derivative from a calculus plus. The subtlety here is that h can go to 0 in a lot of different ways. And so this turns out to be an incredibly strong and restrictive condition. For example, one theorem that you can prove is that if you have two functions like this, two holomorphic functions on the upper half plane, and they agree on any little open set, even one little open set, then they have to agree everywhere on the whole upper half plane. So this turns out to be obviously a very, very strong condition. There's also a lot of other theory. Another thing is that if the derivative exists everywhere, then f is given by a power series extension everywhere. Its Taylor series exists everywhere, and the function agrees with its Taylor series. So there are a couple of other things, to put it mildly, that you would learn in a complex analysis course about such functions, and I will mention them in passing if they come up. Very little will be actually used in here. The other definition is muromorphic. So f from h c is muromorphic if it's the same, except you only require this, or you allow this to fail on a discrete set of points, so points that are spaced out. So if f is holomorphic, so if, let me put this way, so f prime of z exists except at a discrete set of points What? Doesn't seem right to me now. But yeah, without a limit point. So.
This just means that for each point where it fails to be holomorphic, there's an open neighborhood that contains that point, such that in that open neighborhood there are no other points where it fails to be holomorphic. But it seems wrong to me.
And each of them are poles also?
Yeah, poles of finite order. If Z0 is one of these points, Z0 and this, and there's n such that Z minus Z0 the n f of Z is holomorphic. I seem to be lucky to put that in this, but you need that because, for example, e to the 1 over z, that's a perfectly good polymorphic function everywhere except at 0, but it's not meromorphic because its power series, for example, is has infinitely many terms of negative valuation, so there's no power of z that you can multiply by to get something that's holomorphic.
So that's just a missing sentence in the notes, a missing phrase. So the reason you introduce these is because you want, for example, if f is a non-zero holomorphic function, you want 1 over f to be something you can consider, and 1 over f will be neuromorphic. So
for example, if f is not equal to 0, then 1 over f is neuromorphic. But of course, here f is holomorphic. 0 is holomorphic. One over f is neuromorphic.
Thus, you get a field, the field of meromorphic functions on H. Because you can take and add any two together, that certainly won't suddenly fail to have this property. If you take two meromorphic functions, the sum does. And you can multiply two together, and again, they'll be meromorphic. And the inverse of a non-zero meromorphic function is meromorphic. So a collection of all meromorphic functions forms a field. Is a set of holomorphic functions a ring? Yeah. And its fraction field is the neuromorphic functions. Okay, here's some examples. So e to the z is an example of a holomorphic function. And if you take any polynomial such as z minus I and take its inverse, that's any non-zero polynomial, that's a neuromorphic function. But it's not holomorphic because that's a pole at I. But it certainly satisfies this. Now we're almost ready to define modular forms. Actually, we are ready to define modular forms.
Is holomorphic the same thing as analytic?
Yes, it's a deep theorem. They're not, the definitions aren't the same, but in fact, they're the same. The definition of analytic is that at each point, analytic in the upper half plane means that at each point in the upper half plane, the function agrees with its power series expansion in some open neighborhood. And different, and holomorphic is what I've, well, I guess this is one version of holomorphic. So I've defined this, but it's not clear from this definition that this will agree with its power series expansion. But in fact, if this thing agrees with its power series expansion, then it will be holomorphic. And conversely, if it's holomorphic, it will agree with its power series expansion. It's also a third characterization in terms of the so-called Cauchy-Riemann, not so-called, in terms of the Cauchy-Riemann equations. But I don't want to introduce that. So.
also pushy and more pushes. So if ever you see, analytic when referring to a function on an open subset of complex numbers, it's the same thing as this. It's a theorem, but it's equivalent to this. It's not the same definition, it's the same thing. Okay. So now I'll define. I'll make a definition, and it'll already be interesting because it won't be at all obvious if there is anything that interesting that satisfies the conditions of the definition. So here's the definition. A weakly modular function F is a neuromorphic function weight K this phrase weight, or this word weight in mathematics can refer to absolutely anything, but in this course it will refer to a positive, actually to an, well, it'll mostly be a positive integer, but it will allow a negative of zero. So right here, this key is the integer. But in general, math, weight can refer to almost anything. So a weight k is a neuromorphic function on H such that, so far it's not a big constraint, but the condition is that over all z in H and all matrices gamma equals A, B, C, D in S of 2Z, we have F of AZ plus B over CZ plus D equals, Better write more compactly, actually. This will be conceptually easier to understand. So the condition is that f of gamma z times cz plus d to the minus k is equal to f of z. That is, f of z is fixed under replacing f of z by f of gamma z cz plus d to the minus k. And now what I want to do is help you to understand what this means conceptually, because it looks very strange. Right? It's a condition on a neuromorphic function. It's a functional equation. It's an equation where this function is supposed to satisfy. And it's not at all clear that anything will satisfy this except, well, there's some dumb things that will. For example, the zero function. Verify for yourself right now that the zero function works. That's easy. What about constants? Do constants work? If you take a constant function. Well, it depends. You say no. Why do you say no?
I mean, if it's not zero, just plug in.
You're right. If k is not zero,
If it's not the zero constant function.
Well, what about the constant function 1? That could work for some values of k, such as
zero.
Right. Otherwise not. So the constant functions, that's our example so far. So the complex number C, the constants, these are weakly modular functions. They're actually a little better than that. These are weakly modular weight zero. And it turns out that they're not all of them. There are lots and lots of other, tons and tons and tons of other ones. But we'll have to wait a little bit to see what they are. Notice this is something for the homework assignment, but I'll just say it. If you have two of these that are weakly modular of weights k1 and k2, their product will be weakly modular of weight, the sum of k1 and k2. So if you take f and g and multiply them together, and then just use this formula, you end up getting two factors of cz plus d popping out, and the weights add. So just as practice, I'll do that one part of the homework assignment on the blackboard right now.
So f and g weakly modular implies f times g of weights, k1 and k2 implies f times g weakly modular weight, some of the two weights. And the reason is just you take any matrix in SL2Z and any Z, and then you consider F times G of, and now you have to make that substitution, gamma of Z, and then out here you put CZ plus D and minus the sum of the two weights. And to verify that this is weakly modular, all you have to do is check that that is equal to, so I'll put a question mark, 2f f times g of z. So that's the question. And now let's verify it, let's prove it. So on the left-hand side, I'll rewrite this as cz plus d minus k1 times cz plus d minus k2. And now f times g of gamma z, that's by definition f of gamma z times g of gamma z. Now f and g were assumed to be weakly modular functions of weights k1 and k2. So each of these, well, you just put the first two together, the first factor and the third factor together, and you get f of z. And you take the second factor and the fourth factor, and you get g of z. And that's by definition f times g of z. Okay, so the product of two weakly modular functions is weakly modular. And by the same sort of argument, you see that the quotient of two, as long as the one that you're dividing by is non-zero, that's again weakly modular. So in fact, you get a field of weakly modular functions of say weight 0, because then, you know, 0 plus 0 is 0 and 0 minus 0 is 0. So there's this huge field of weakly modular functions. So what is it? During Stark's class, it's generated by J. And if you're not, you have to wait and see. So now, I'm going to tell you a more conceptual way to think about this expression, which is certainly easier to remember and to understand. So, I'll just state this formally. So, consider the formal expression f of z dz. So think of this as a differential form. And the other half. And let's get the weight into play. Oh, by the way, this explanation I'm going to give you only works when k is even. Fortunately, there aren't any weakly modular functions except the zero function for k odd. So for that, you have to take a specific matrix, gamma, namely the matrix minus 1, 0, 0, minus 1, and you plug it into this formula, and you'll see that there aren't any non-zero functions of odd weight. That's another one of the problems. Okay, so it's safe to assume that k is even here, so it makes sense to write k over 2. This is a formal expression, but it's the sort of thing that you formally accepted over and over again in calculus class, so I'll belabor that.
So now look what happens. This expression, well, if you take the circle equation over there, it just says that f of z, dz to the k over 2, this is equal to f of gamma of z, d gamma of z to the k over 2.
It just says that this differential is invariant under replacing z by gamma of z, under the change of variables given by any element of SL2z. So to check that is simply an exercise in differentiation calculus, but and using the definition. So like here, you know, d gamma of z, that's the, you know, the derivative of the quotient rule. So this is what a modular, a weakly modular function of level 1 is. So
level 1. So we'll talk about ones of higher level
in a few minutes. So it's a function on the upper half plane such that when you consider the differential f of z dz to the k over 2, that differential is invariant under the action of gamma for any gamma in SL2z. So that's it. That's what they are. So this is equivalent to that. So that's conceptually how to think about it. It's not just a bizarre abstract definition that happens to give you something interesting. It's a little bit better. These things are really differentials, possibly k-fold differentials or k over 2-fold differentials on the upper half plane that have this invariance condition. And when you have something on the upper half plane with an invariance condition, namely, it's fixed under the action of some group, that really passes to give you the corresponding sort of differential on the quotient. The quotient of the upper half plane, by the action of SL2z, is the Riemann sphere, punctured at infinity, punctured at one point. So really, weakly modular functions, they're essentially the same thing as differentials on the Riemann sphere. But the problem with differentials on the Riemann sphere is it's a little bit difficult to think about them, and you certainly have to know something about Riemann surfaces to think about them. It's a little bit more concrete to think about functions on the upper half plane. And you can, as long as you just translate the condition like this. So if you have a function up here, then since this is a quotient map, you take the map from the upper half plane to here and then compose that with your function on here, and you get a function on the upper half plane. That only works for weak zero, though. Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a subtlety. You have to be careful to distinguish between the modular form and the differential, because they're certainly slightly different objects. But that's it. What is a modular form of level 1? It's a function on the upper half plane so that the differential f of z dz to the k over 2 is invariant under the action of SL2z. It's fixed under the action of SL2z. That's it. Okay? Questions? So remember this. Now, of course, the big question at this point is, are there any of these? And I'll leave that for a moment. One nice thing is that, and notice I haven't used the SL2s generated by S and T yet, but because SL2z is generated by these two elements S and T, in order to verify this condition, or equivalently this condition, all you have to do is verify it for the generators of this group. Because, it's easier to see in this definition. This says that f of z dz to the k over 2 is fixed under the action of SL2z. And if you have a group and it's generated by S and T, like SL2z is, then if something is fixed under S and T, it has to be fixed under the entire group because of the way this action works. Actually, there's something to check there. You have to verify that, and this is true. So I want to make sure I get the ordering right. It's a right action in this. So you have to verify that it's really an action. We should check that because it's important.
Let me see if this is precisely. So I'll do it in as concrete of language as possible. SL2Z acts on the right on functions, on the set of all neuromorphic functions H to C. And it's just an algebra to prove this. But you have to prove that if you have gamma 1 and gamma 2 in SL2Z, and for notational purposes, let's let this is the standard notation. So F bar gamma is, by definition, this CZ plus D to the minus K times F of gamma Z. So that's just the definition of this. Then F bar gamma 1, gamma 2, this is the same thing as F bar gamma 1, bar gamma 2. So once you have this fact, then you can see that to verify that a function is invariant under the entire group SL2Z, it simply suffices to show that it's invariant under the two generators of SL2Z. And that condition that it's invariant under the two generators of SL2Z is pretty simple, because the two generators are themselves very simple. So the condition is that, so again, I'll put it right here. Equivalently, for all z in H, you have that f of z plus 1 equals f of z. So this is the generator T, which is 1, 1, 0, 1. And f of minus 1 over z is equal to z to the k f of z. And this comes from the generator S equals 0, minus 1, minus 1, 0. Sorry, the sign's wrong. Which one did I choose? 0, minus 1, and 1, 0. So all you need is that for all z in the upper half plane, these two conditions are satisfied. If you have a function on the upper half plane with these two conditions, then it is a weakly modular function of weight k. So I think I'll verify this for you. So let's see why this is true. That is to say, why is this proposition true? And this is, again, simple algebra. So let me just write it out. So on the left-hand side, we have, we're going to evaluate each side at an element z and see what we get. So on the left-hand side, you get I don't remember if there was a... I'm doing this on the fly. It might be a dumb trick to do this. I want to forget. Is there a dumb trick for doing this? So it's just multiplying it out. I think so. Yeah. No, but this is... I mean, you're really using something about how the action is defined here. For example, if you tried to state this and the action was from the other side on the left, say in the wrong order, you might think that often you see group actions that act on the left, and it would be false. It is completely false. So you still have to use something here about your definition. Oh well, I think it's important. So see how it goes. So this is by definition the lower two entries of gamma 1, gamma 2. You can prove it. Nice formula for. Oh, let me include a k in this, actually. Because there's a different action for each k. Yes?
You're about to tell us what that notation is.
I think I defined the notation here. Yeah. Okay, any questions? So I defined the notation here. And you actually have, for each k, you have an action,
of course. So
I'll use so capital J of a matrix means CZ plus D. So capital J of a matrix A, B, C, D is by definition CZ plus D, just like that.
Okay.
Okay, so this is this, gamma 1, gamma 2, z. So that's the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, we have, so again, we're evaluating each at a point z. So you have to be careful to get the ordering right. So you have this function. So let's see. So on the other side, so I don't know whether these are equal or not. So we have here, let's see, so I'll just do the thing inside the parentheses first. J of gamma 1 minus K of gamma 1 of Z. But remember, gamma 1 of where the argument is. And then I have to do bar gamma 2 K of Z. I need to now apply this. So really, on the right-hand side, it's J gamma 2 minus K, J gamma 1 minus K, F of gamma 1 of gamma 2 of Z. So already, things look somewhat promising. Notice that we have F of gamma 1, gamma 2 of Z over here, and F of gamma 1 of gamma 2 of Z over there. Now, there are two things. One is that this is equal to that. Namely, f of gamma 1 gamma 2 of z is f of gamma 1 of gamma 2 of z. That uses that linear fractional transformations do act from the left on the upper half plane. And that's, again, a similar type of check. Namely, that gamma 1 gamma 2 of z, if you take the corresponding functions and compose them, you get the same thing as gamma 1 of gamma 2 of z. Well, I mean, it's just the action of the functions that doesn't say that. So you have this for linear fractional transformations. You do have to check something there, but I'm going to assume this part. So this f cancels with that f. So all you have to do is check that the lower two entries of the product of two matrices is the same as the lower two entries of one times the lower two entries of the other. Wait, that can't be. Oh, I'm sorry, I left off one crucial thing. Notice that there's a z in j of gamma 1 to the minus k. That's a function of z. If gamma 1 is a1, b1, c1, d1, then j gamma 1 is c1, z plus d1. So there's a z in there. So when I make this substitution, so this whole thing, J gamma 1 to the minus k, f of gamma 1 something. This is a function, and I have to replace everywhere in this function the z by gamma 2 of z. So right here I have to do that substitution. So right here this is really c gamma 2 of z, c1 gamma 2 of z plus c2, I mean plus d1. Okay, do you understand why that's important?
No.
Keep the minus key. Okay, so now I think it's right. So these two factors cancel. And now we have to verify that j gamma 1 gamma 2 to the minus k is j gamma 2 to the minus k times this other factor right here. That's what remains in the algebra to check everything. So see, it's really not completely trivial to show that for each k you have an action. But it's a useful thing to show because it allows you to see, for example, if a couple of matrices generate, what happens in general. And in fact, this will be used over and over again to prove a lot of different things, the fact that this is an action. Now let me finish. So
We still have to show. We still need to see why. Say gamma 1, gamma 2, minus k, is equal to j gamma 2, minus k, times c1z plus d1, minus k. And we can, of course, delete all the minus k's here. If you know that, if you can show that you have an equality here, then you just take the minus k power of that equality, and it gives you the equality that you want. So this is what's left to show. And here the notation is that gamma I, for I equals 1 to 2, is ai, bi, ci, di. Okay, so now let's see what happens. So this makes sense. Oh, geez. When I copied it over here, I neglected the crucial down into a C. Now, it's crucial that you have that there. There's no way this is going to work without that. Because this thing on the right, without this, the thing on the right would be a polynomial of degree 2. It would be a quadratic polynomial. This would be a linear polynomial. So it would have to fail. But this is of degree 0. It's going to be the image of a linear fractional transformation applied to z. So it has degree 0 as a rational function in z. So the degrees at least match up. OK? So now let's figure this out. So we're only interested in the bottom two entries. So we don't have to worry about multiplying the top entries. So the bottom two entries, the left one is C1A2 plus D1C2. And the bottom right entry is C1B2 plus D1D2. I don't care what these are. Did I get that right? Okay, that's good to me. So that tells us what this is. This is C1A2 plus D1C2Z plus C1B2 plus D1D2. So that is the bottom thing for gamma 1 times gamma 2. Now let's figure out what it is on the other side. So here we have, so C2Z plus D2, that's what this is, multiplied by, now we have C1 and then gamma 2 of Z. That's A. But don't be afraid by the A. Don't be afraid of the A. Because our matrix has determinant 1, so we'll be able to deal with this. So A1Z plus B1 over C1Z plus D1, except that these should be 2s. Okay. Plus D1. Okay, and now you can multiply through, and the first factors cancel, so you get C1 A2Z plus B2, these cancel, plus D1 C2Z plus D2. Okay, and then multiplying this out, this is C1 A2 plus D1 C2Z plus C1 B2 plus D1 B2. C1 B2 plus D1 D2. So fortunately, the constant terms match. We have to think a little harder to see what happens. Actually, we don't have to think very hard. So the linear terms match as well. So it works. Unwinding the algebra, we found that these two are equal. And by the way, we have a useful rule. If J is by definition the expression that I've defined, so J of gamma is CZ plus D, then we've just computed J of the product. It's J of the second thing times
J of the first thing with Z sub, with Z replaced by the second thing applied to Z. But it worked out. This is equal to that. This is true. And that was all we needed to get this equality. So in fact, you do have a right action. Okay? All right, so now I'm going to tell you about Fourier expansions of modular forms and modular functions, and weakly modular functions in particular. So I need this in order to define modular forms precisely. So the one very frustrating thing for you at this point, probably, is that you haven't seen any modular functions at all, except for the constant ones. Even though there are lots and lots of them, you haven't seen any. Now I'm going to talk about a theory of Fourier expansions for them, even though you don't have any to think about at all, as far as examples go. Just to emphasize that you don't have any to think about, so here's a perfectly good holomorphic function on the upper half plane, z, a constant function z. Is that a weakly modular function of any weight? Is z a weakly modular function? So remember the definition is that f bar gamma k is equal to f. That's the definition of a weakly modular function of weight k. Does z ever satisfy that condition? Where, again, f bar gamma k, that's cz plus d minus k f of z, f of gamma z. And again, you only have to check this condition on the two matrices, S and T. So does Z satisfy these conditions for any K? So, like, for example, the first condition says that the function is invariant under z goes to z plus 1. Does the constant function z, is that periodic of period 1? Can you? So, that doesn't work. So, if you do f of z equals z does not satisfy this. So, I'll make kind of a list here. F of z equals z, this fails to be a modular function of any weight because modular functions in this condition have the property that f of z equals f of z plus 1. All z. And it's certainly not the case that the constant function has the property that you get the same thing if you add 1 to the input, right? Because you get 1 plus 1. What about the function e to the 2 pi iz? Is that a weakly modular function? Any ideas? So remember, it's just two things you'd have to check. One is that f of z equals z plus 1. You have to check that for all z, and then this condition is equivalent to f of minus 1 over z is equal to z to the z to the k f of z. So what about the first condition? Does f of z equal to f of z plus 1, does that hold for all z for that function, for e to the 2 pi iz? So just check it. E to the 2 pi I z plus 1, that's equal to e to the 2 pi I z plus 2 pi I, and that's equal to e to the 2 pi I z times, just by rules of exponents, e to the 2 pi I. And a very famous equality is e to the 2 pi I equals 1. This is e to the 2 pi I z. So e to the 2 pi iz, it's almost, I mean, it's along the way. It satisfies f of z equals f of z plus 1 for all z. But what about the other condition? Does it satisfy f of minus 1 over z equals z to the k f of z? Why not?
Just plug in what it is.
Yep. And basically nothing works.
Move all the e's together and then it can't equal the thing you have left over.
Excellent. So it doesn't satisfy this. So yet another function is not a weakly moduli function. And you can go through the list of all the functions you would learn from calculus, and none of them work. None of them are weakly moduli functions, except the constant functions. Okay, so now in order to sort of eventually write down weakly modular functions, or more specifically modular forms, I'll talk about Fourier expansions. So let's suppose, even though we haven't found a single one yet, suppose this is weakly modular of Vk. Then, as I just mentioned, f of z is equal to f of z plus 1 for all z. And now you can do the following seemingly sneaky thing. Well, let's let q of z be the function e to the 2 pi I z. And let's think about what that function does. Well, if you consider it as a function on the upper, the complex numbers, it's kind of complicated. But if you consider it as a function in the upper half of them, what is its image? So if you take something, a positive imaginary part, and you substitute it in here, compute the absolute value, you find that it's less than 1. Let's say less. All right. I want to do it that way. So. I stupidly wrote closed unit disk in the notes. I mean, there's no problem with that since the open unit disk contains the closed unit disk. I mean, sorry, the other way, since the closed unit disk contains the open unit disk. But let's let D, for our purposes, be the open unit disk. That's the image. Well, you don't get the point zero in there, but that's the image of this function. Because the image of this function is contained in there. So. This way, you have the upper half plane, and then it maps via z maps to either the 2 pi iz, which I'll call q, to another, a subset of the complex numbers, namely the open unit disk. And if you, for example, substitute z equal to 0, which is not in the upper half plane, then you get 1. And this boundary then corresponds to the part that you've excluded here. So you get the open unit disk. And the point 0, well, e to the 2 pi iz doesn't equal 0 for any complex number. But if you take the limit as z goes to infinity, say along the i-axis, then that limit would go to 0. Because here, you're substituting an I times t for t getting larger and larger, so you get e to the minus 2 pi t, and that goes to 0. So formally, it makes sense to send infinity to 0. So you get a map that's on the upper half plane union infinity to onto the open unit disk. So that's what Q is. Now, here's the neat thing. Q is also periodic with period 1. That is that Q of z equals z plus 1. Q is not a weakly modular function, but it's still going to be very useful for understanding the modular functions.
Q of z plus 1?
Oh, sorry. neglected is in this one. Do I have that mistake anywhere else on the board?
No. Okay.
I made it a little bit earlier. So Q of Z is equal to Q of Z plus 1. Now, F also has that property. So here's what you can do. You can write little f, well, over here. You can write it as a power series in Q. So here's the picture that explains why you can do that. I'll begin just by recopying the picture on the other blackboard for clarity. This is Q, and Q satisfies Q of Z plus Q of Z plus 1. Actually sends this strip exactly onto this disk that the origin moved. And our f is a function on the whole upper half plane, the complex numbers, that's what f is. So what we want is a function like this. See, f is a function on the whole upper half plane, but f satisfies f of z goes to f of z plus 1. Therefore, f is completely determined by what it does on this strip. So if you so let me make the statement. There's a function f capital F from this disk to complex numbers such that little f of z is equal to capital F of Q of z for all z in the upper half plane. And the reason, so f is a function on the whole thing, but you can just restrict f to this and you don't lose any information. Or more precisely, if you give any point out here, you can just add 1 to it or subtract 1 to it multiple times and you'll get something in here. How do I say it? You can also think of it this way. So this Q defines a bijection between here and there. So you just take the inverse and then go over. That's how you define capital F. So you can think of capital F as just being the inverse of Q enclosed with little f. I guess that's the simplest way to think about it. But the crucial thing is that notice that you couldn't define it this way if f wasn't at least periodic of period 1. Because this function, capital F of Q of Z, is clearly periodic of period 1 since Q is. So it would be wrong. But you just define capital F to be Q inverse composed of little f. I am brushing over the fact that Q defines a bijection between the strip and the open unit disk. And that's an easy thing to prove from complex analysis, but I think I'm going to brush over that, and you should accept it. Okay, so now how do you get a Q expansion? Well, we have a function f on the open unit disk, and it's somehow associated to little f, or capital F is. So the thing you can do is, well, you can ask about the nature of this function on the open unit disk. Is it holomorphic on the open unit disk? Does it have a power series expansion everywhere, etc.? And when it does, well, it has a power series expansion. So you would get a power series representation for f in terms of Q. If f is given by a power series, you've then given little f by a power series in terms of Q. So you translate the question of trying to, for expansion of little f, we're trying to represent it by a power series, but you can think about that completely
as a question of whether or not a certain function on the open unit disk has a power series expansion. And that question's easier to think about because you have a good theory for complex value functions on the open unit disk. That's what complex analysis is about. So, by the way, just so this really makes sense in the open unit disk, notice that there's one sneaky thing, which is that, which is again what happens at the origin, but, and this won't work always, but you can define, well, I guess it's okay if you throw in community for that, but it's okay. So just define capital F at the origin, capital F is zero, equal to the limit as z goes to I infinity of f of z, if that exists. All right, so, okay, so what can we do now? There are a couple of things. So given a holomorphic function on the upper half plane, I've given you a way of defining a function on the open unit disk. That function on the open unit disk, you can ask about its analytic properties. So now I can make another definition. So I'm going to get rid of the weakly part. A modular function is a weakly modular function such that capital F well, it has a power series with finitely many negative terms, so it's meromorphic at the origin, such that capital F is meromorphic at zero. So it's just a condition on this function f that you get from the fact that your function little f is completely determined on this strip, and you can think about this strip via e to the 2 pi I z as being the open unit disk. So the condition modular function, which is a slightly stronger condition than weakly modular function, is simply the same condition, except you make the additional constraint that when you define this function f, it's meromorphic at zero. And under that condition, that means that f has a power series expansion with finitely many negative terms. Hence, you can write f of z equal to the sum as n goes from some integer m, possibly negative, infinity, a sub n, q to the n. So when you have a modular function, it has a power series representation like that. Yes?
So is it automatically going to be analytic everywhere else but zero, or not necessarily?
Yes, it will be analytic everywhere else.
Or is that why you're only requiring?
Yeah.
Okay.
If it were a modular form, which is what I'm going to do in a minute, then it would be analytic everywhere else. This is automatically meromorphic everywhere else, because I'm starting with F being a weakly modular function. So F is meromorphic everywhere in the upper half plane, which implies that the function capital F is meromorphic in this disk, except possibly at zero. And the condition to be a modular function, as opposed to a weakly modular function, is simply the additional condition that it's meromorphic at zero, which you could also think about as meromorphic at infinity. This is the very rigorous definition of meromorphic at infinity. I could have just waved my hands and said that a modular function is a weakly modular function that's meromorphic at infinity, and then you might not know exactly what I mean. But you can make that completely precise, as I did. You simply choose this isomorphism between the strip and the open unit disk, and then you just define f to be f composed of q inverse on this open unit disk, and obtain a function capital F on the open unit disk. And then to say that little f is meromorphic at infinity is the same as saying that capital F is meromorphic at the origin, has a power series of finitely many negative terms. And now finally, I can tell you what a modular form is. That's easy at this point. So modular form F from H to C of level 1 and weight K is a modular function that is defined that's holomorphic everywhere. So as a function on the upper half plane, it should be holomorphic everywhere. And holomorphic at infinity, which means that this Tower series has no negative, no terms of negative exponent. So holomorphic at infinity means that f of z equals sum a n q. Remember, q is just e to the 2 pi iz, so write it that way. E to the 2 pi iz to n, for n going from 0 to infinity. So that's very precisely what a modular form of level 1 is, and weight k. And one observation that I won't prove, but again follows from complex analysis, is that this f actually does converge to this power series for every c in the upper half plane. And the reason for that is, well, if you translate this over here, what we have is a holomorphic function on the open unit disk, and it's holomorphic at the origin, therefore in some neighborhood of the origin it converges to its power series expansion, and you can figure out how big that neighborhood is, if you just go out until you see a pole, but the function is defined in the entire open unit disk, so the radius of convergence, so to speak, is 1. But again, that's a result from complex analysis, and I'm not going to require you to do anything with that in this course. So just a fact. F, in fact, converges to the power series for every z in the upper half plane. So, equality holds for all z in the upper half plane. So now, that's actually really useful because it gives you a way to think about it. It gives you an alternative way of thinking about a modular form. It's something presented by a formal Tower series. And in practice, they often come up in number theory. And these a sub n are often integers, so you can think about a modular form as just this list of integers that give the coefficients. Unfortunately, if you take an elliptic curve and then consider the coefficients a sub p that we defined, you know, a sub p is p plus 1 minus the number of points, and then you extend that to a definition for all composite n, you don't get a modular form in this sense. These modular forms have, when you emphasize level 1 and some weight k, it turns out that the modular forms attached to elliptic curves have level bigger than 1. Now, I keep saying this level thing. The only difference for a higher level, well, there are two differences. So let me define modular forms of higher level. Everything works exactly as before. Only thing you have to do is replace SL2Z by a subgroup of SL2Z. So, by the way, any questions about this definition before
we go? Yeah, why are you emphasizing that it holds for all z in the graph? I just thought I would.
Why? Well, why not? But actually, here's why.
I don't know.
Here's one reason. at the beginning of class. Yeah, I mean, you don't need that for the definition. You would just require this in some little neighborhood. But remember at the beginning of class. Not this class, but at the beginning of this course, I showed you some pictures of modular forms that I graphed.
And in order to graph them, I needed to know that alpha is given by its power series everywhere.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I might be graphing total nonsense.
Yeah.
So that's one reason. And in fact, you can use this to draw 3D pictures. And there's a nice bound on the A sub n in any particular case, so you can bound the error in your picture.
So when you say that you can calculate large modular forms, what's the large mean? So that's how you sort of described your research at the beginning of the class.
Maybe I meant a large number of modular forms. Well, but there are various things that can be large. For example, the weight k could be large. If you want to calculate all of these forms of weight k, and k is a couple of thousand, then it's kind of hard. There are a lot of facts, though, that you have to know about in order to make sense of computing these. For example, here's an extremely useful and amazing fact. If you fix a weight k, the space of modular forms of weight k in level 1 is finite dimensional. It's a finite dimensional complex vector space. So it makes sense to compute a basis for it. And computing a basis for it, well, you can explicitly give one for any k, but if you want to, well, there's some subtleties that come up. Take a while to describe. But let me just finish by telling you about modular forms of arbitrary level. So here's a group. For each positive integer n, we define gamma 1 of n to be matrices, and I did this right at the beginning of this course as well. The matrices in SL2Z such that C is congruent, well, the whole matrix is congruent to 1 star 0, 1 modulo n. This is gamma 1 of n, and if you make the definition that we had before, you can define a weakly modular function of weight k for gamma 1 of n. The definition is exactly the same, except instead of requiring the condition f bar gamma k equals f for all gamma in SL2Z, instead you require it for all gamma in gamma 1 of n. So it's a weaker condition, since gamma 1 of n is a subgroup of SL2Z. So for every gamma, you require this, and you get a weaker condition, hence you can get more modular functions, weakly modular functions of weight k. And then you define modular functions by requiring meromorphic, not just at infinity, but you have to require it at a couple of other points, and I'll talk about that next time in detail. So it's infinity plus a couple of other cusps. That gives you modular function, and modular form is holomorphic on the whole upper half plane, just like before, holomorphic at infinity, just like before, then holomorphic at a couple of other points, which is something slightly different. That gives you modular form, and that's it. So you have a notion of modular forms of weight k for gamma 1 of n. And this, the finite dimensional complex vector space of these will denote by mk gamma 1 of n. It's a finite dimensional complex vector space. It's about dimension roughly k times n squared. And it turns out to play a huge role in number theory. For example, the modular forms attached to elliptic curves are elements of n2 gamma 1 n, where the minimal n that works, is the conductor of the elliptic curve, which I mentioned before. So next time, I will finish giving a precise definition of this. All I'll have to do is tell you the analog of holomorphic at infinity, but for the other cusps. And then you have a precise definition of this space. And there. And then finally, I'll show you some elements of it and how to. And then, really, the goal for the next month is to tell you how to compute this space explicitly on a computer, which is a lofty goal, but I want to try to aspire to. Modulo a few details. When I say I could tell you how, I don't mean how to type in a command, I mean how that computer actually works. Okay, any questions or comments? Reminder, there's a graduate student research seminar that everyone should go to tomorrow, or not tomorrow, but Wednesday at 1 o'clock. It's about random matrices, and there will be California Pizza Kitchen pizza this time.